This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen, with you on today's episode, experts of all different types, to be honest, we're marking Sleep Awareness Week, kicking off with adult sleep, the gold standard of sleep hygiene, and if those gadgets are actually worth your money, and turning our attention to the small people transitioning from cot to bed and some of the common traps that parents fall into. We were in conversation with John Bell of Bloom World Academy ahead of a post-16 centre that they are setting up. This is about real world readiness, from budgeting to the emotional side. It opens in September and they're offering 100% scholarships as well. And turning our attentions to saving you some money and saving the planet too. How do you fancy getting those household bills down? We were telling you how. And it was podiatrist Sarah Khan in the studio helping out with all of your lower limb issues. Lots of messages coming in on the text line. Come on then, tell me, how did you sleep last night? It is Sleep Awareness Week, bringing in the best of the business. We're talking adult sleep with Julie Mallon now. She's a sleep consultant from Nurture to Sleep. She can help everyone from teeny tiny babies all the way to, well, us. Julie, happy sleep week. Can I say that? Is that weird?
No, not at all. It's music to my ear. Good, very, good. Very helpful.
I feel like I'm in your bad books, to be honest, because... I'm not even going to hold back. I'm tired, so there's going to be no filter on this. My family were really annoying me last night. So when they all went to bed between 9 and midnight, I stayed up watching absolute rubbish TV. I had a sandwich and then slept really badly. And I think it's that kind of self-sabotage that a lot of parents in particular do, to kind of carve out a bit of time for yourself. And the sleep is the one that pays the price. So I didn't sleep very well last night at all, but I wondered, when you're working with adults, what are some of the most common issues that keep coming up time and time again that we can help people with this afternoon, Julie?
Well, the first thing is to say it happens. You know now you're not going to be doing it again for another couple of weeks, so it's fine. It's just when we repeatedly. So that's the first thing. And I did wonder when we were messaging, I was like, why are you messaging me back at this hour? I did wonder. Anyway,
too funny, because I was watching Married at First Sight Australia and eating a sandwich.
Okay, so in terms of what is coming through, so much is stress. You know, stress from work, stress from, you know, having young families, young children, and just the pressure of being in an environment or being in a world now where it is 24/7 on. There is no off. So those are the things that are really coming up time and time again.
Mm-hmm. And we've spoken about sleep hygiene, which I find quite an interesting term in the past. But for one that's not familiar with it, when we're talking about adults in particular, the gold standard of sleep hygiene in terms of behaviours and environment to really optimise sleep. Would you mind talking us through some of your golden rules?
Yeah, and I actually say sleep health as opposed to sleep hygiene, because I also associate it with the dentist and it's got all these negative connotations. So I think sleep health would be my preference. But in terms of sleep health, it really is very unique to you. So one of the golden rules for me, because I know that's what impacts me, is that to come off all devices before 1 hour before bedtime, because I know, due to the sensitivity of myself, that it will impact my sleep in a negative way. So you have to be true to yourself and recognize, like you, for example, last night, your sleep hygiene, sleep health wasn't the best that it was, but you know why. Mm-hmm. So in terms of gold standards, it is about limiting your exposure to electronic devices. And that we know is because, not just because of the blue light that it emits. And I think what's really difficult is there is so much conflicting advice out there, but actually, untold from all our neuroscientists is that the impact of screens on our sleep has a negative impact. And it's also to do with the content. So it's not just about what's coming off the screen, but it's also the content which alerts our brain.
I think that's
another thing
right.
would be, another thing would be that consistent bedtime. It is absolutely critical of all the things that we do. Having a consistent bedtime and a consistent wake-up time, again, really, really important. for promoting absolute optimal sleep.
Julie Mallon with us today. We have got some messages for you, Julie. One asking about, are sleeping tablets bad news long term? I think we probably know the answer to that, but maybe you can unpack why sleeping tablets aren't the same as getting a proper good night's sleep. If that's a strange distinction to make, would you mind unpacking that a little bit?
Oh, very definitely. It's all to do with the chemical makeup of the sleeping tablets. And what the research is showing to us unequivocally that it helps you fall asleep quickly, but your sleep is so fragmented and it really impacts the quality of your sleep overall. So the rapid eye movement sleep is disrupted. Our deep sleep is disrupted. And we know that the golden standard for insomnia, for example, is cognitive behavioral therapy. That we know is what is going to be the best intervention for insomnia, not sleeping tablets.
Julie Mallon with us. We're going to be talking next about nocturia, getting up to pee in the night. Apparently, it's affecting around half of men aged between 20 and 40. So what is going on? And how does Julie Mallon feel about sleep gadgets, the Whoop, and even a mattress cover that costs $3,000? Are they worth your hard-earned dirhams? Joining us from Nurture to Sleep, it is Julie Mallon. We've been talking sleep hygiene and I want to talk gadgets now because, well, we've had all sorts of endorsements from big names talking big money. There's something called the 8 Sleeps Pod 3 cover, a mattress cover that can heat or cool your bed, tweak the temperature, it gives sleep tracking. It's $3,000. But on the kind of the more accessible level, we're seeing an awful lot of people loving their Whoop bands. Message here saying sleep is critical for creating a base for readiness and recovery. I love my Aura ring. Can't live without it. I've been tempted to get one. How do you feel about sleep tracking, Julie? We're all leaning into the data. Do you feel like it can be beneficial or can we get in our own heads a bit?
I think it depends on you as an individual, because some people it can really cause anxiety. And also, we don't really need something to tell us whether we've slept well at night. We don't need to wake up in the morning and you know whether you've had a good night's sleep or not. So these are one of the downsides of, you know, the technology. We also need to know that it cannot tell you how much deep sleep you've had. It cannot tell you how much rapid eye movement you had. Now, they're really, really good in terms of heart variability, oxygen saturation. This is where they are now becoming more and more accurate. So that's positive. But they absolutely cannot tell you whether you've had your desired quota of, you know, that stage 3 or your rapid eye movement. And even if it did, what can you do with that information? It's not that you are going to be able to work on increasing your deep 3, because, you know, with every neuroscientist out there, every sleep, you know, serious neuroscientist, they couldn't tell you. Matt Walker, for example, Professor Matt Walker, Professor Grandner, none of them could tell us how we can get more of, say, deep 3 as opposed to stage 2 of our sleeps. So where they are, I think, and certainly that's what all the data is coming up with, showing us, where they're very useful is they will present a pattern. And it's with that pattern that then, again, you can be proactive about making changes. So that's where they are really helpful. But again, if somebody thinks they're really wonderful, then that's all that matters.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about a term I was not familiar with today until today, nocturia, getting up to pee in the night. It is something, I'm not going to lie, I kind of associated with mostly men of a certain age, which is the kind of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and I say that because my father-in-law was staying with us recently and was waking me several times in the night with the comings and the goings. But research is now showing that this can affect 44% of men aged between 20 and 40. So nighttime wakings for weeings. Julie Mallon, what do we need to know? What's going on?
I think the first thing we need to know, or ask the question, why? Why is that happening? Now, a lot of these, you know, the protein shakes are really high in caffeine. And we know that caffeine is one of the reasons that will cause us to wake up during the night. So it could be that if somebody is on a particularly high protein shake for, you know, wanting to really enhance their fitness and their metabolic rate and all these wonderful things, which is really positive. But if it has caffeine, that will absolutely increase your need to have a pee during the night. Mm-hmm. So certainly the guidelines are, if you're waking up twice or more during the night, then you do need to go and see your healthcare provider. But before you do something like that, it would be looking at, you know, when was the last time in the evening that you had your fluid? Remember, we know that adults require 4 to 5 liters of fluid for us to stay hydrated. That we know in a 24-hour period. We know that 40% of our hydration actually comes from food. So things like cauliflower, 88% of a peach is water. So we get a lot of our hydration from our food. So it's just recognizing, when did you have your last drink of fluid? Can you limit it to earlier on during the day? But also to have a look at the content of your protein shake, mm-hmm. for example.
Yeah, and so yeah, as you say, that kind of the when, because I know a lot of people super busy during the day and might be thirsty in the evenings and trying to kind of rehydrate then. We had a message earlier saying always sleep deprived during Ramadan. So we are, you know, coinciding, of course, with the first week of the Holy Month of Ramadan and Sleep Awareness Week. And I wondered if you had any advice for anyone whose sleep patterns will inevitably be disturbed by a change of habits and lifestyle right now, Julie. And I guess maybe even kind of getting back on track when the Holy Month ends.
So just going back to hydration, we know that when we are dehydrated, our sleep is absolutely impacted. So between iftar and suhoor, make sure that you really increase in terms of your fluid intake. A really nice little tip would be that you take coconut water, because we know that the electrolytes within the coconut water hydrate us much more efficiently than water. So that's something we can do. The second thing is the power of a strategic nap during Ramadan. You know, we know that 26 minutes, according to NASA, is the golden timing, perfect nap duration. Now that, but look at where we're having those naps. So make sure that you can, as much as you can, take a nap, because that will really support the change in your sleep pattern. Another thing that will be really, really helpful is, I loved it when you had young cannibals and you were up dancing. Honestly, all I could think of was, this is going to help you sleep tonight, Helen, because in that kind of movement, we know prepares the body for its nighttime sleep in terms of the human growth hormone, which really helps with our deep sleep. So movement is really important, you know, just, and it's also going to help with that glucose curve, because we know that during Ramadan, that, you know, there's these beautiful, wonderful, wonderful family celebrations. But a lot of the food is a lot richer than you would normally have. And therefore, that has a very, very negative impact on your sleep. And it does, because it really ramps up your core body temperature. And so that, when your core body temperature is raised, then that is cancelling out your melatonin. So there's a number of things that we can do. Of course, keep off your screen as much as we can. But definitely hydration, gentle exercise, and look at the food that you're eating. Really important.
Great advice. I am blushing that you caught me having a little dance in the studio. But why not? Have a kitchen disco tonight. Julie, yeah. Helen, thank you so, so much. We have been talking about adults today, but you can help a huge amount when it comes to babies, toddlers, even teens. So if you'd like Julie's details, you can send me the word sleep. Julie Mallon speaking to us from Nurture to Sleep. And yes, Julie, I'm going to be a good girl tonight. I'm going to get back in. Yes. No more married at first sight and messaging you on Instagram at midnight. I promise. Speak soon. Travel safe and happy sleep week. We've just been talking adult sleep, marking Sleep Awareness Week, but what about the small ones? They do tend to be the ones that can impact our own kip as well. Claudine Gillard is with us today, the founder of Sweet Dreams Sleep Consultancy. We can help you out about schedules during Ramadan. We can help you out about getting into routine, when you should even do that. Thank you so much for your time, Claudine. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Helen. Thanks for inviting me on.
My pleasure. I think this is a really noble job, because the impact that you must have on family life, family dynamics. I mean, everything is so much harder to cope with when you're tired. And I've been there in the trenches on the front line of an hour and a half to get a child to sleep and then commando crawling out of the bedroom. And what I would say, now that my kids are older, 7 and 9, to anyone who is dreading those bedtimes, who is doing those things where I wore this t-shirt last night and they had a good sleep, or I put them in the cot in exactly this way and it worked well, and those little superstitions, it does get better. Claudine, when we're thinking about little ones in particular, what are some of the myths and misconceptions that you'd like to address? Maybe things that you're hearing parents come to you with, you're seeing on social media and going, well, if you've just forgot about that, things will get better.
Yeah. I mean, your listeners can't see me nodding, obviously, but I've also been in the same situation that you described you experienced, Helen, before I knew any differently. And, you know, I always say to parents, if something's working for you, then there's not a problem. So, you know, if you find a way to make things better or improve, you know, there's something that is a solution that might not work for another family but works for your family, then go with it. However, there is a lot of, let's say, misinformation or advice that it probably doesn't work for every family out there that I see on social media or when I go to presentations where I do talks and that kind of thing. The reality is that what we do as sleep consultants in the company that I operate is that we empower parents and give them the knowledge and the strategies that they need, that they've come to us for their child to be able to sleep without the parent doing something on their behalf. Mm-hmm. So in other words, without the child needing the parent to physically fall asleep. And that is the kind of key to a child sleeping through the night, and the child sleeping through the night is where our sleep isn't disturbed, because obviously at our bedtime, our child's bedtime, it's not normally our bedtime, but if our child wakes up at 2 a.m, typically most of us are asleep or want to be asleep at that time, and so that's when it impacts us the most.
Mm-hmm. How have, I'm kind of nervous about saying the word sleep training, but I guess how have attitudes around sleep training changed in the time that you've been a consultant, and what do you feel like the latest kind of, I guess attitudes are around it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a general feeling that people decide it's either for them or it isn't. I think it can be quite a divisive topic or something that people are quite passionate about. And part of that is that there is a lot of misinformation that it kind of draws on studies that isn't really accurate to what personally we in my team do. Most people, every time I talk to a family, most people will say, I don't want my child to cry, or I would like my child to avoid crying as much as is physically possible. And I always say, no one has ever called me saying, I really don't mind how upset my child gets. You know, we're all parents. We, you know, love our children. We don't have children to kind of disadvantage them in any way. Mm-hmm. So none of us are thinking, oh, you know, results despite the journey. Mm-hmm. What my approach to sleep consulting is, let's make the journey as easy for all concerned as possible, because the end of that journey is the beautiful future where everyone's sleeping well. Oh. And it's really, really important not to disregard that piece, because when everyone's sleeping well, obviously that benefits the whole family.
Absolutely.
So that's how we take it on for families. That's how we sort of encourage families to think of it.
Claudine, we're going to be talking about Ramadan and how this can affect the whole family after the traffic. But for now, I wanted to ask you, outside of the holy month of Ramadan, the importance of a bedtime routine, this winding down time. And I guess I'm talking from babies, really, those sleep cues that you can start to give your children that, okay, lights are going out, Mum and Dad leaving the room now. What are some of the key components to a good wind down routine?
Yeah. I mean, I think a bedtime routine is suitable for everybody. I mean, I work with people of all ages, including adults, and a bedtime routine is paramount to adult sleep as well. So it's really important for children because it's signposting, it's signaling for children who are non-verbal, so very young babies. We're talking about showing them a pre-sleep process through our actions, and for children who are verbal, you know, action is still being very much a message they've understood for a long time. So it's the same thing in the same order every night. It's a calm time, it's a limit on the time, on the length of time. I mean, it's not 2 hours for any age child, but it's age appropriate length. So for a younger baby it would be 15 to 20 minutes. For a sort of toddler, school age children, it would be 30 to 40 minutes. And it's an opportunity to just get your sort of mentally and physically ready to fall asleep. So that's why it's calming. That's why it's repetitive. that's why it's activities that they sort of like, but it also are low key. So you wouldn't want it to be, you know, playing horsey or running races. It's reading books and cuddling toys. But it is just the conduit to a good night's sleep, because from the point in which the routine ends and the intention is that the child goes into their bed, that's, you know, that's their time to put themselves to sleep. But the bit beforehand is us teaching them that sleep's coming next.
We got quite into baby massage for a while and it massively backfired because my two-year-old would start screaming in the night, "Mommy, massage!" I was like, oh my goodness, I've created a monster, absolute diva Dubai child. But again, we came to you the other side. We are going to go to the text line next. Claudine Gillard is with us today, the founder at Sweet Dream Sleep Consultancy. We've had a message about transitioning from crib to bed, making that transition smoother. And how about nightmares too? Daughter's four and having them frequently. How can I make it feel more secure about being in her room alone at bedtime? Got a couple of messages in a couple of minutes, so a quick fire round now with Claudine Gillard, the founder of Sweet Dreams Sleep Consultants. No name on this message for you, Claudine, saying, "My son is transitioning from a crib to a bed. It has been a challenge getting him to stay in it. Any advice on making the transition smoother? My eldest daughter didn't realise she could get out of it for a few blissful weeks, and then she realised and it became an absolute battleground." A common question and concern for lots of parents. What are some of your golden rules for that time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, age is a really important one. I really don't like moving children to beds until they're at least 3 years old. I sort of say to parents, if your child's still young enough to nap, they're still young enough to be in a crib. But if your child is above three, the person that's contacted the show, if your child is above three, then no issue. Or if your child was dangerously, attempting to get out of the crib in a way that they would hurt themselves. We use a sleep training clock. If you Google sleep training clocks, there's a whole raft of options that come up. And basically you say to your child, that clock is the thing that determines whether or not it's morning. And morning is when you can leave your bed. So essentially, it's not me. I'm not the one determining it's morning. It's the clock. And you need to respect the clock. You can also put a stair gate across their bedroom door. I would suggest you go to a pet shop and get one that's big enough for Alsatians or large dogs, because children of this age are obviously very inventive and very determined. So a nice big stair gate. Sometimes we recommend you get a handyman in and you get a plinth and you raise the stair gate up off the ground, obviously safely on a wooden plinth to make it taller. Because what we're saying there is, it's not safe for a child to wander around the house in the middle of the night by themselves. They could walk into a wall. My son walked into a door handle once, which obviously was pretty unpleasant. So what we're saying is basically safety first. If your child isn't in a crib, let's turn the bedroom into a crib. Mm-hmm. Put a safety gate on the bedroom door. Clear the room of all things that could be potentially dangerous. So, you know, either get those items that you can put safety locks on the cupboards or the drawers. Or remove anything from the room, and then use the clock to determine whether it's morning or not, which is when you can leave your bed. And if you leave your bed, as far as you're going to get is the safety gate at the end of your, you know, bedroom. And then the final thing is not to be in the bedroom when they fall asleep, which was the thing I mentioned earlier before the break. Mm-hmm. If you're in that room when your child falls asleep, chances of them sleeping through the night pretty much nil.
Whew. We've run out of time. I have run out of questions, though. So, Claudine, for anyone that got in touch with a question, I'm going to send them your details there, if that's okay. It's Sweet Dreams Sleep Consultants. It's been really, really fantastic to catch up with you. Thank you for the no-nonsense and understanding advice. I think it's resonated with an awful lot of people, judging by the messages we've got. Claudine Gillard, thank you so much for your time. We're talking education and actually looking at post-16 studies with something of a new angle. John Bell is with us, the principal of Bloom World Academy, and opening in September, they've got the next centre is for post-16 studies, aiming to redefine the pre-university educational experience. Some lofty goals there, Mr. Bell. How are you, sir?
Yep, good afternoon. Thank you very much. Yep, some lofty goals, but I think we can do it.
Well, I speak for the parents, which is, we love how safe Dubai is, but we worry that we're not perhaps preparing our children for the quote unquote real world. I kind of resent this Dubai's a bubble thing, because it is very much real life for a lot of people. But this readiness is a really big concern for an awful lot of parents, from, you know, budgeting to safety to social side. And then, of course, you've got the educational piece. So tell us a little bit about the Nexus Centre and where the idea has come from.
Well, I mean, you've touched on most, or if not all, the important issues that we have to deal with. Of course, we're very fortunate living in Dubai. But we have to prepare youngsters to be ready to go to university anywhere. And children here do go everywhere. So really, we've brought together some important, you know, concepts, really. The most important is, of course, passing your exams. And, you know, that's that duty of care that we have. Any child that comes to Nexus at Bluemort Academy is, everything's geared to making sure you get the right results and reach your potential. But alongside that, it's a sort of future readiness program. And that future readiness means, look, we've got to work out certain things. We've got to work out financial readiness. You know, bank of mum and dad may stop. It may keep going, but you've got to do some...
Mine's... The buck is going to stop.
Yeah. I mean, some schools call it wealth management. And it may be, there may be quite something in that about, readiness for the future in terms of pensions and things like that. Mm. But we're also talking about day-to-day management of money. Now, that's an old concept, but we want to do that well. But also it's a bit more than that. It's the social and emotional things that we really want to make sure that young people are prepared for. You know, going to, and many will, go to London, New York, for example, and I don't want to be particularly judgmental about those cities, but they're probably not as safe as Dubai. Now, where you sit on the tube or train, looking behind you when you walk home. Now, the thing about city universities, or, you know, quite often your accommodation is out of town. Mm-hmm. So how do you manage that, mm-hmm. you know, seriously, and planning for the future with that?
I mean, even me, when I go back to the UK, I'm like leaving my handbag on the back of chairs. And, you know, just like you do get very used to living in a certain way. And I think to be having these conversations, and yes, I think budgeting is a really important one. I know an awful lot of people, myself included, had some pretty skint times at uni, and that can teach you some good lessons. But, you know, knowing the difference between a credit card and a debit card, or understanding when money's coming in and when it's, you know, what's going out. These are the life skills. I mean, I would argue some of this should be taught by parents, but I feel like the school has a role to play too.
Well, indeed. I think it's partnership, and that's the basis of this, is parent, you know, Bluemort Academy, it's all about parent partnership. So, you know, we have many children that are more than prepared to go. But, you know, it is true to say that one of our most vulnerable groups is arguably what people possibly think is our least vulnerable group, you know, some young men. Young men going to university, girls for all the wrong reasons over a lot of time are, you know, for the wrong reasons, are more emotionally and probably socially prepared, you know, about where they sit on a train to avoid parts of a bar or a pub, dare I say, when you go to these big cities. It's all there. Boys, some not. So we've got to do some work there. But I don't want to be too, you know, bleak about it. It's just we are fully aware that there is much more to growing up. And we talk about pre-university, which is really important, but we're talking about after school, really. You know, children will learn, or young people will earn their living in all sorts of different ways. And that being prepared to be flexible. The phrase we use a lot is knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's really about that future readiness. And that's often about knowing people who will help.
I think you said the word bleak there. And I think it's important to talk about, you know, some very real life scenarios, problem solving. But to my mind, I would hope that when my kids get to 16, 17, 18, it's about empowering them, about making them confident to be able to walk into a situation or walk into a room and, as you say, know what to do when you don't know what to do. We are talking today about the Nexus Centre. It's opening this coming September 2024. Admissions now open. It is talking about future-ready life skills, but it's also a flexibility aspect that I'm really interested to find out more about, because learning hours are going from 8 until 8. So what's that going to look like in practice? We'll find out next with John Bell. Do you feel like when your child, your teen, leaves the UAE, if they do at age 18, that they will be fully prepared, not just academically, but also armed with essential life skills, ready for tertiary education, ready for life beyond school? We're speaking now to the principal at Bloom World Academy, John Bell, head of the Nexus Centre opening this coming September, which is looking to redefine the pre-university educational experience, so post-16 studies. Interestingly, I wanted to ask you about the flexible timings, John. Now, Bloom World Academy, you do start kind of quote-unquote later than many UAE schools for reasons we've discussed on the show before. Nexus Centre is going to be having flexible learning from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. Tell us more.
Well, it's an extension of what we already do. I believe we're still the only school in UAE that starts at 9 a.m. every day. And we extend that day in different ways anyway. But for the post-16 students, the older students, it's just an acknowledgement of children, young people learning different ways. I think everybody possibly can remember if they were at university. Some people do early, some people do late, some people do last minute. Mm-hmm. So we just thought we would build that into the timetable. So we acknowledge we've got these fantastic resources, wonderful facilities, purpose-built centre. Why not see it being used in the evenings too?
How does that work with teachers then in terms of those resources?
Right at the beginning now, we are adjusting contracts and times in which people work. So for example, if you're overseeing, we already do this. We say we're a no homework school. What we really mean is we give children the opportunity to do homework or extended learning in school, personal learning time at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. That's a recycled idea. Many schools have prep time. We just do it officially. So we do a bigger version now at the pre-university setup. So basically there will be teachers on duty. If that's the case, they may start later in the day. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is to make sure children get the guided hours. Now, combined with that, we're flipping the learning. And that's a phrase in the education world is probably a fairly old term now, but we are genuinely flipping the learning. So the course outline, the course program, the IB program is all published up front. So children know what they've got to do and can go at their own pace. So not waiting for the teacher. The teacher becomes a facilitator. So consequently, you may learn best at 7 o'clock at night. You may learn best. And those hours are open. We're even thinking of going further because we do acknowledge and we do understand that children learn at different rates, different pace of time, mm-hmm. Pace and at different times. So, yeah, it's just a real opportunity to use what we've got and to do what's right, I think.
So, Ibrahim, you've kind of partially answered that question saying, is this IB, what about class sizes? Is it recognised outside the UAE, e.g. university points?
Oh, completely. I mean, IB is now the currency, in my view, my personal view, but my professional view is the currency. I mean, when I started in the IB world, there were parts of the world that didn't like IB so much. The US universities, for example, and the English British universities weren't so keen. Now, IB students are totally prepared. The whole tenor of the learning is about organisation skills, research skills. And you can imagine, if you start doing that young, you do that with a primary years programme we do at Bloom World Academy, right through to what is going to be the diploma programme, or an important this one, careers-related programme. This is what we'll be undertaking in the pre-university setup that we will have. That means our children have opportunities for work experience, internships, on the journey. When you put all that together, these young people go to university, and I'm being serious now, IB will say this worldwide, that universities are beginning to look at their first year because their first year, when you learn how to research, learn how to study, which is a lot of the first year at university, mm-hmm. our children can do it. Yeah. Our children, our young people can really do it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about scholarships because I know at Bloom this is something you have offered and worked with families on. Is that going to be the case post-16?
Very much, yeah. Well, look, it's all about fit. You know, we've been very fortunate. We have 73 nationalities of children. We've genuinely blended our community. It's a genuine international community. We look for potential, of course. We also have a significant, we're genuinely inclusive, genuinely inclusive. Every child has a learning achievement passport, means they have their own plan. So we talk about equity. We don't treat all children the same. We treat them all differently because to reach their potential, they need that. And the scholarship is an extension of that. So we are offering 100% scholarships for the right students for the post-16 Nexus Centre. So you can come, the right student, the fit in with our school, and partial scholarships on that journey for the right families. Because this is, you know, we started this journey, and thank you previously inviting me in to talk about it. But this has generally been founded on a family-first school, family partnership, because you know, the most important people in the world to any child is, do their parent or parents and teacher really get along? Mm-hmm. And the Bloom World Academy works so hard at that. And that's the power. And that's why the Nexus Centre is a real extension of that. Parents and teachers deciding with the student together, where's it best to go next?
John, would you mind telling us about the space? Because I think about that kind of classroom environment, but it sounds more like a university campus.
Completely. It's the heart of the school. So it's the role models of the school are going to be our oldest students. It's a double story, gigantic, curvy, state of the art space. we have a little lecture theatre in there. We have seminar rooms. We have our own, or they will, the students will have their own coffee bar, bistro, a comfy seating, and a DP or a CP, diploma program, careers program, purpose-built library. Combine that with a social space, so the other things you may expect to see in a school for to keep the older students amused. Individual cubicles or seminar rooms, counselling room, all in one space. They can disappear in there and not come out. But we'll use the rest of the school too. Mm-hmm. But this is their dedicated space.
Messages here saying, is it open for tours? Another message saying, IB was amazing for my younger daughter. Great prep for uni in Dubai. It's bloomworldacademy.ae and you have got a Nexus tab on there. But to Aparna's message about tours, is that open?
Absolutely.
Yet,
well, we do tours every Tuesday. This morning we had over 30 parents touring the school. Tomorrow will be the same. They are the open mornings. I meet and greet. We have a big conversation. We tell about the school. And parents then get a tour with the senior leaders of the school. We do individual bespoke programs when parents got individual questions, if you like. On a Thursday afternoon, we do a virtual tour. And so it's all online. Parents from all over the world join us. We are inundated at the moment in the nicest possible way.
Good for you. Clearly tapping into something there.
Well, I hope so. Lots of schools always talk about personalisation. It's impossible. Mm. But customisation is. And that means doing a little bit different for every child. We claim to do that well. You know, every child's got a plan. Every child has an opportunity to make choices during the day, different subjects, different times. And then you combine that now with, for me, and I hope you can tell, my personal passion, but the passion for the school is creating Nexus. Because, you know, we live in an international community. The language has got to change. The roadmap's got to change. We don't need to just talk about examinations. You've got to remember, this generation of children are the most enlightened about things like environment and sustainability. They get innovation, most of them. They really, really do. They understand technology. So we have to, if we don't meet that face-to-face, toe-to-toe with these children, then we are not innovative. We are not progressive.
And
we are trying to do that.
Yeah, well, thank you so, so much. I think it's a really important conversation and loads of people wanting more information. So if you want to send me the word learn, I'll send you the link. There's information there about admissions, about tours, about the space. John, thank you so much for coming.
Pleasure.
In.
Thank you very much.
Always wonderful to speak to passionate educators. Nexus Centre opening in September.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
We are saving money and maybe a bit of the planet as well today as we talk about how to save money on your energy bills. Matted Fired with us today, DSM Strategy and Policy Lead at the Supreme Council of Energy. I presume you are a passionate environmentalist as well as on hand to save us a few dirhams.
Definitely, yes. First of all, thank you, Helen, for having
You're
me.
So
I'm very pleased
welcome.
To be part of the show.
Tell us about where this passion for the planet came from initially.
Well, it came from because I'm originally from the mountains in Lebanon, and just seeing the nature and how all elements of nature are together mm-hmm. and living in completely harmony. So that's where it came from.
You see the kind of innate value and beauty, and I think then you have a greater respect, right?
Definitely, definitely.
Now, I don't want to jinx it, but after the rains at the weekend, I felt the sun felt a little bit stronger than it had done for a while, and I started doing the whole, should we start to turn off the water heater? The AC seems to be on more. So can we start with air conditioning? What are some of your golden rules for getting efficiency out of those bits of kit and ultimately bringing our bills down a bit?
Mm-hmm. So perfect. You started with the right spot in your house, because cooling contributes to 70% of your electricity consumption. So if you can target cooling and make cooling more efficient, this is how you reduce your bill and save on the planet. So for cooling, there are multiple ways in order to make cooling more efficient. First, you can simply turn off the AC when you're not using it, as simple as it is. You know, if a room is unoccupied, the space is unoccupied, turn off the AC. The second rule, which I find sometimes weird because people don't know it, is to set the thermostat, the AC thermostat, at 24 degrees.
Oh,
not 18.
Say that again.
Yeah.
And I'll send the podcast to my husband.
Exactly. Set it on 24 degrees, not 18, not 20, because the temperature, the appropriate temperature to have indoor, a proper indoor air quality and indoor environment is between 22 and 26. So you don't need 18 and 20.
Oh.
Yeah.
Your work here is done, my friend. What about the auto versus on? That's something we fall out about in terms of efficiency, because on ours we can have it auto and it kicks in at a certain temperature, yeah. Or it's on consistently. And I'm always thinking, if it's on, it's going on and off, is that effectively stressing the machines more?
Definitely on auto is better than all on because of the fan, but also the temperature is a very important thing that you have to consider. There are other ways as well. Like you can check on the AC filters. You need to clean them periodically because dirty AC filters make the AC run inefficiently and thus consuming more energy.
Now, I think I probably speak for a lot of people in Dubai. We didn't realize just how leaky our homes were until this weekend. Mm-hmm. I was there mopping up for quite a while. That must, I mean, obviously it was rain on Saturday, but that must have an impact on cool air escaping as well.
Yes. Well, on cool air escaping and on heat coming inside the house. So I think, having considering sealing and ensuring that the windows and the walls are properly sealed is very important to reduce your consumption.
Majid, can we chuck some technology at this? How do you feel about smart homes, you know, especially energy efficient appliances? Where do you think we can be spending our hard-earned dirhams and they could be saving us some as well, hopefully?
Yeah, definitely. You know, after the AC, you have the appliances. You have your dishwasher, your washing machine, the dryer, the iron. And you need to hear, if you're buying new stuff and new appliances, it's better to invest in energy efficient ones. But how you would know if it's energy efficient or not?
I have no idea.
Yeah, so you look at the card behind the appliance, on the back of it, and you will see 4-star or 5-star label. So go for 4-star and 5-star, not 1 and 2, where... Because 1 and 2 would, you would save much more money on 3 and 4.
So a manufacturer would need to disclose that information in terms of just how efficient these products are?
Yes, and here also the ministry has that label on all of these appliances, so...
It's interesting.
Easier. It makes it easier for the consumer to check it.
So choosing the right item is crucial, but how we use it. You know, I'm just thinking about, well, either timings or... You know, how full they are, you know, all those kind of myths about, you know, you should only boil a kettle at a certain... I have no idea. Tell me, what do we need to know?
But it's a brilliant point. If you get an efficient, for example, water heater and you keep it always on, you didn't save money or on the planet. Well, you have to use it only when you're supposed to use it. And this goes also with the washing machine, the dryers, and also running these appliances at full load and not at partial load. Because partial load can cause inefficient operations and thus you're wasting energy, water and money.
I saw a great little, do you know people are like, oh, I read this article. It's like, you saw it on TikTok. I saw this documentary. That was on Instagram. I saw a video earlier, which was about smart bulbs as well. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people have made that switch to LED. But can we see a natural, you know, correlation between making some of these switches and our electricity bills?
Well, definitely, because like LED compared to LED compared to fluorescent and incandescent are more than like 80 or 90% more efficient. So you would see a 80 or 90% drop in the lighting load, definitely. So you're saving 10% on your energy bill by switching to efficient lighting, definitely.
Oh, Majid fired with us today, DSM Strategy and Policy Lead of the Supreme Council of Energy. We've been talking about inside the home. Up next, we're going outside, swimming pools, watering gardens. Should we be getting our own solar panels? I am interested to find out. We are saving you money and yes, helping out the planet too on the show today.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
We're looking at reducing those monthly energy bills now with Majid Fayed, DSM Strategy and Policy Lead at the Supreme Council of Energy. And really thinking about little daily habits that make a big difference. But there are some kind of significant things we can do to address those numbers as well. We've been talking about inside the house, so LED light bulbs, making sure that ACs are efficient and clean, energy efficient appliances as well. What about outside? Watering plants, and I say this as a lot of the gardeners in our area just seem to love washing pavements, and we have these kind of deluges of water in the street. Yeah. When are the best times to water plants or grass for the planet and for our pockets as well?
Yeah, definitely. So the first rule, if you're watering the plants and the garden, The first rule is if you can do it early morning or in the evening, because the sun is not there, then you reduce evaporation. But there's also more advanced methods of doing it. You can use drip irrigation, where and it's a more efficient way of irrigating plants, and this can reduce your water consumption for sure.
We've had a message here saying, I'm renting an apartment, would love to make some major changes like installing solar panels, but just not possible. I'm going to speak honestly, baffled by the lack of solar panels. And I wondered if you would mind explaining why we're not seeing them utilised by developers more. And ultimately, if we own our property, what powers we have to actually put them in place.
Mm-hmm. So definitely. But before we highlight the solar panels, like we've spoke a lot about energy efficiency solutions, which we're talking about in this show. But first step for us is to reduce our energy consumption before we generate energy. You know, before we generate clean energy and clean energy, we need to reduce it. So if you're covering that part, you're doing a big job. On the Dubai level, we have the Dubai government and Dubai Electricity and Water Authority has a plan to decarbonize the grid. So, and we have currently more than 15% of the electricity in Dubai provided by solar energy, to be 25% by 2030. So that part on the grid part is taken care of by the Dubai government. But also there is another program called Shams Dubai, which encourages people and residential and commercial buildings to install solar panels. We have more than 500 megawatt peak in Dubai readily installed using these decentralized social systems.
That's very cool. I've got someone I want to introduce you to, because I feel like a lot of people don't maybe know that that's an option to them. So obviously it's an investment, but we're looking to offset your bill, but also kind of the planet as well. And we had a message about swimming pools, saying about heating, chilling, covering. Any insights there?
Definitely. For swimming pools, I think a very easy way, if you're not using the swimming pool and during summer, first thing you can do is covering it. You know, you don't need it to be. And there are these like bowls that you can add to the swimming pool that avoids the evaporation of water, and thus you can reduce your water consumption. These are used in hotels, and it's really, really nice because it gives also a nice look for the swimming pool and as well safe on water.
I'm going to Google this right now. Are there any resources that you like, any podcasts, any books that you feel like more people should be, you know, because it's a choice really, isn't it, to inform ourselves ultimately on the impact on the planet. But really, when we're looking at saving some money as well, where do you like to point people if people want to learn more about energy efficiency?
You can visit our website, My Energy, My Responsibility, which provides you a lot of insights into how to reduce your energy and water consumption. But I would like also to highlight a book by a friend, Mission Zero, which is a children's book for children below, I believe, 15 years old. And it gives you insights into why it's important to save our planet, why it's important to save on energy, water, and teaches children on these important aspects.
Well, you've raised a good point there, because my kids are the ones that are marching around the house going, Mummy, turn off the tap while you brush your teeth.
I love that.
It needs to come from them. It really does, because they are the ones that are going to be living with our decisions. In the meantime, though, we all have a role to play. And whether your motivation is planet-focused or if it is indeed saving money, it really, really does add up. Just thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having
really,
me.
Really, really fascinating. Would you mind just repeating the website? Because we've had a message here from Julie. So is My Energy, My Responsibility?
Yes.
Okay, amazing. If you want to send me the word energy, I'd be happy to share that. Great resource there for information, some stats to get you going in the right direction. We're talking feet this hour. Sarah Khan is with us, podiatrist at Genesis Dubai. She's got, I was going to say, more than a decade of experience working between private practice and the NHS in the UK, and then hospitals and clinics here in Dubai. I'm so interested in what you do, genuinely, Sarah. But why is it that you do what you do?
Why feet?
Why feet?
Yeah, it's an interesting job, and I think it certainly takes a certain type of person to want to look at feet all day. But I really enjoy it, as I've been looking at feet for the last 17 years.
Gosh.
So it's a long old time, but it's very interesting. I think feet are probably the most forgotten about part of the body. We all have them. We all use them. But more often than not, people are really ignoring problems that
That's
they have.
That's interesting. So people get used to, you know, certain pain or certain limitations. I mean, there's a lot going on in the foot and that kind of lower limb when we think about, you know, number of bones, ligaments, muscles. So presumably quite a lot that can go wrong.
Completely. Yeah, 26 bones, 33 joints and over 100 soft tissue structures. So a lot. It's a lot going on in a very, very small area. But people sometimes almost normalise the pain and they put it down to I've done too much or I've walked too much in the wrong shoes. And we shouldn't normalise it because more often than not, there's something more going on that's causing that.
And then presumably if you're having problems with your feet or your ankles, that can then transmit up the body into different problem areas. Maybe even that's where you're feeling the pain.
Completely. I would say your feet are your foundation. You know, you are the building. So yeah, if something is wrong, then it is going to radiate everywhere.
Oh, right. Let's talk about what we can help with this hour. As I said, already messages coming in for you, Sarah. But can you give us an idea of maybe what's coming into clinic, some of your areas of interest and specialty, so we can help as many people as possible live on the show?
Yeah, of course. So I see patients ranging from babies through to 100 years old. Podiatry is really very broad and it covers everybody. And it can be anything from your foot pains to nail conditions, skin conditions. Ingrown toenails is a very, very big one. Warts or verrucas, as we know them.
Had a few messages on those already, just so that you know.
And for me, diabetes is more my background with patients.
Would you mind explaining the relationship, the correlation between diabetes and, I guess, poor management of diabetes? And why someone might find themselves with a podiatrist?
Of course, again, like I said, the feet are forgotten about. So with diabetes, if there's been poor management or lack of control with the diabetes, two of the main things that can happen are the diminished blood flow and the diminished sensation in the feet. So certainly in this region, if we look at the diminished sensation, it can be things like people going to the swimming pool and then walking around the pool barefoot and burning their feet without even realizing it. So it's really important for them as patients to ideally get a check on their feet once a year, which I think, unfortunately, in this region, it's not happening at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I'd really like it if it's something that could be more prominent in the healthcare system. But yeah, ideally once a year, and come and have a very simple little test. And we look to see, how is your blood flow? What is your sensation like? Are there callus patterns on the feet that, again, might be leading to pain in your knee or the way that you're walking? Mm-hmm. Footwear, even. It's one of the things here that, because apart from the weekend just gone, we don't have bad weather. So our shoes sometimes look a lot better than they actually are. They can be really worn out, but they still look brand new.
Okay, right. Lots to talk about today and lots to help you with today. We've got Sarah Khan with us, podiatrist at Genesis Dubai. Sarah Khan is in the studio, podiatrist at Genesis Dubai. She's been looking at feet for 17 years and is looking at the text coming in now. This listener is keen for us to do settle an argument. This is your chance. H saying, she says in brackets, German husband, insists that our toddler needs sturdy shoes year round, whereas I'd like more barefoot time. Who is right? Now, you're a podiatrist and a mum of a toddler.
Yep.
So perfect question for you, Sarah. What's your take?
So actually, I think they're both right. So it doesn't really solve their argument, but our environment here in Dubai is very unique on our feet. Where everything is very flat and very hard. So having a mixture of proper footwear and barefoot time is actually really good, depending on the activity. So if you are going and walking around Dubai Mall, for example, have something that's going to be supportive and the kids aren't going to be dragging their feet and complaining of being tired. But if you're out at the pool, at the beach, let them run free. Have that variance in, you know, different textures, different inclines, and that different feeling on their feet as well.
What does it do for the feet? And I'm not just talking about toddlers now, but I guess us as adults as well, in terms of having different, you know, textures, different, you know, inclines and declines. Why is that important?
One, it's to do with your sensory in your feet and getting used to that. But also, almost exercising your feet. It's one thing that we don't really do. We might go to the gym, lift weights, or do other exercise classes, but actually exercising our feet is not something. So having these different textures is quite important.
I don't want to get in trouble here. Are there anything that you would never put on the feet of your children, whether that is a style, maybe not a brand, but you can give us some clues?
Closed plasticky shoes that you see that are very fashionable at the moment.
Got you. Might have some accessories that you can force
exactly
through. Interesting. And why is that?
They don't really give any support. Also, the type of material I would say here can lead to sort of some excess sweating in the feet, leading to fungal infections. But saying that, they are easy for the pool, the beach. It's more, say, try not to walk around too much in them.
That's fair. That's totally fair. Different shoes for different things. A message here, and we are talking kids in this segment in particular, just because of the messages that are coming in live, but we can talk about adults as well. So if there's anything that's stressing you out, you maybe need to get to the bottom of some symptoms, do get in touch, Sarah, with us through until 5 o'clock today. Message here saying, our 8-year-old son has viral warts on his feet. We've tried the cryo treatment, but it's very painful and not working. Any other way to fix it? Laser, this parent says. Okay. Is that verrucas?
Verrucas, yeah. So verrucas is the term that we would know it as, but it's actually part of the HPV virus. There's about 5 strains of HPV that actually attack the foot. And part of the trouble with treating verrucas is we don't actually know which strain actually reacts to which treatment. It's not a dangerous virus. And part of the reason why they kind of hang on for dear life is because the body doesn't recognize it as being a problem. Right. So it might be dealing with tiredness, stress, colds, sniffles, everything going on. It just kind of forgets to deal with that. It
doesn't prioritize the verrucas.
Exactly.
So what have you found to be efficient in treatment?
So here I found actually trying to almost dry them out because of our environment, plus the pool, the beach, the water. So trying to dry them out and almost dehydrate them works for some patients. But cryotherapy also works for some.
Painful though, as this parent says, really, really painful. So I know this probably isn't what this listener wants to hear. Will they just go away on their own?
They can do. They can. If it's painful, it might be down to more the location rather than the actual verruca itself. Causing sort of pinching or compression because they do get that hard skin layer over the top of them as well. So it does depend on location.
With your permission, Sarah, can I pass on your number to this listener?
Of course you can.
Okay, perfect. Tell you what, we can open this up to everyone. If you want Sarah's details, you can send me the word feet, you can send me the foot emoji, and I will send you Sarah Khan's details. She is practicing there at Genesis, but we have stolen her away from a very busy clinic. Sarah Khan from Genesis Dubai is with us answering my questions, but most importantly yours, about your feet. We've had a message from Naz here saying, can a podiatrist really help with plantar fasciitis, or is it something you can solve yourself by getting really supportive shoes? Before we talk about the hows and the treatments, what is plantar fasciitis?
So it is basically a pain in your heel or the sole of your foot. Quite nasty, can be quite debilitating. And it can be in both feet, it can be in one foot, it can come and go for some patients as well. But it's, again, it's quite important to have it looked at properly because, yes, there are things you can do at home with stretching, exercising, rolling your foot on a ball to help, getting the right footwear, the right footwear for the right task. But it's quite important to kind of look at why has it happened. What has actually caused it in the first place so that it doesn't come back? Sometimes patients want the quick and easy fix, but it's not always the long-term fix.
I had it after having a baby.
Yep.
And my goodness, getting out of bed in the morning and putting my foot on the floor would literally take my breath away. It was like, and then within, you know, a couple of minutes it had gone. But I understand that for a lot of people it lasts far, far longer. So root cause, Naz.
Root cause.
Okay. Tony saying, hi, Helen. Great show. Love the breadth of topics. Me too. I learn something every single day. Tony's asking, are there any benefits of walking barefoot on gravel each day? It's supposed to ground you. I mean, the grounding conversation, I think, is a really important one.
Yep. And it's very big right now. Gravel, yeah, I don't know how uncomfortable that might be for some people, but again, you see people walking on these nails. And doing the breath work with it.
Exactly. I've done that when I've done ice baths before, kind of more like almost acupressure mats you can get. Yep. Is there any benefit to that?
Again, yeah, you can get even these socks with the pressure in, and it's all, again, about stimulating those little nerve endings that are on the feet.
I'm worried about offending people by asking this. So I'm going to ask it. I love reflexology. Mm-hmm. And when I go in, they're like, oh, you're having some, you know, kidney problems. I'm like, I'm really not. You're just pressing on that particular part of my foot really, really hard. How do you feel about reflexology? Is there any truth in these correlations between body parts and foot zones?
I actually did it as a course after I trained as a podiatrist, just as something else to have. And it was quite interesting looking at that sort of holistic approach versus the orthodox medicine. So I do believe that there is something there. But I'm not necessarily on side with you have a blister because you're unhappy. So,
yeah, might just be some new shoes.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people do have a very emotional response to reflexology. And sometimes often I've got a friend who gets nauseous. You know, she can make her feel quite sick. What about pedicures?
Ooh, hot topic.
I know, she said, stirring the pot.
Listen, we are in a culture here where we have pedicures. It's something that is on every corner, every street, and our feet are out a lot more than perhaps they would be in the UK. I think perhaps in the UK I'd have a pedicure once a year.
It's also really expensive in England.
Yeah.
Like mega.
I think as long as you have somebody that is good and not prodding and poking too much where they're causing you pain. Mm. I often say to patients, a pedicure should be something that's nice. You're paying for a nice experience, you know, having the foot massage and the nail varnish, not coming out with an infection or crying necessarily.
Yeah, no tip for you. What about nail varnish then?
Nail varnish, I don't mind. I always say to patients, limit it if you can. Not a big fan of gel on the toenails because I find it heavier on the toenails. So sometimes when patients take it off, they have bruising or there's cracks or the nail isn't quite as strong as it used to be. But normal nail polish, I'll let patients have.
All right, Sarah with us today. No name on this message. You can always reach out anonymously if you prefer, saying what causes heels to crack? So mine are getting painful from the cracks, and it can be incredibly painful. What's the science behind cracked heels, and what are some of your go-tos for remedying?
So again, it can be a number of things. You can have deficiencies in things like B12, vitamin D even, that can cause itching, dryness in the skin. So it's always important to maybe, again, look at the whole picture. But here in Dubai, the heat, the AC, the water, we don't really soak our feet. We don't really have a bath. We maybe have a quick shower. So we're not soaking our feet that often. So the dryness in our feet, coupled with flip-flops and the sheer forces from them, can cause the cracking. Dependent on how cracked they are. Now, obviously, this caller is saying that they're very cracked and painful. I would usually say see a podiatrist because they might need some debridement with a scalpel.
What's that?
Taking it off with a scalpel, but it doesn't hurt.
Say that word again. Debridement. Interesting. So this is kind of removal of rough skin using a scalpel.
Exactly.
That sounds and then very pleasing, actually.
It's treatment at home. It's always a joint or team effort with my patients, but using a moisturiser that has urea in it, or 10% urea, which is a keratolytic, so it helps break down the hard skin.
Okay. Right. We are going to bring in producer Chloe in just a minute because she has a question. No name on this one. We talked about footwear in kids earlier, Sarah, but what about us adults? Anonymous message saying, I'm early 40s. I've got mild hereditary bunions, which have been causing some discomfort. I would welcome for like this some ideas of shoes and brands that don't look like they're for the elderly. I don't know if anyone else remembers like the kind of shoes that are advertised in the back of like Sunday supplement magazines where it's just like really ugly lace-ups. Are there any brands? And I guess presumably there are some brands that lend themselves to certain conditions, you know, pronations, you know, foot widths and things like that.
Yeah.
So with bunions in particular, anything you, any of your go-tos?
It's quite hard, actually, because obviously it depends on how severe the bunion is, what pain they're getting, but also is it necessarily the shoe that we need, or do we need internal support with the orthotic? You know, it doesn't have to be a customized orthotic. It could be something quite simple, but to change the pressures or how the foot is functioning. One of the things I used to do when I was back in Wales, when I would do talks, was get everybody to take their shoes off, draw around their shoes, and then stand on it and draw around their feet. And the amount of people that the foot was so much wider than the foot. Now, I'm not saying go into the shoe shops and necessarily do that, but we have to have an awareness of sort of the toe box and the depth of the toe box as well.
Hope that helps. And if you do, I think it might be, as you say, it might be worth having a proper chat about hereditary bunions. So I'm going to connect you off air. Come on, Chloe. What's stressing you out about your feet, love?
Oh, I get so many ingrown toenails. And just listening about the pedicures, I was like, oh, yeah, I got one the other week. Yeah, and it was like all flared up and angry at me.
Oh, only no.
The one toe. It's fine.
So what causes ingrown toenails?
Could be a couple of things. Sometimes they're almost hereditary. So I've got patients come in and say, my dad has this, my mum has this. Footwear can play a big part.
Well, yeah, you wear flip-flops every day.
Like every day of my life.
Yeah, she's Aussie. She's all right.
sandals.
They're breathing. They're not, you know, confined, your feet.
I have sweaty feet as well. Listen, God. I'm going to be really open. I have sweaty feet. I've got ingrown toenails. I use gel polish. Everything you've said, not to do.
Like zero points for producer Chloe. So in terms of treatment, I mean, we've heard a lot about, you know, I guess surgeries, procedures. Mm-hmm. What are they? Why do they work? And how permanent are those as solutions?
So when I look at an ingrown toenail, I always go for the more conservative treatment first, because can we solve it with, say, changing the pressures on the feet, some lifestyle changes, environmental changes? Is it caused by a certain activity that you do? So looking at that first off, maybe doing a little bit of sectioning of the nail to clear it out. If it is something that's a more persistent problem, certainly if people are getting repeat infections, there's a little procedure that we can do called nail avulsion. So this is just done very simply, taking a little section of the nail away down to the root, and then we pop a chemical at the root. Here we use sodium hydroxide, and that then kills off the nail cells. So hopefully stops the side of the nail regrowing.
Hmm. Tempted, Chloe?
Tempted. If I can get a couple of days off of work
no
after.
No chance.
Helen.
No, your microphone's going down. She's going down. Sarah Khan, podiatrist at Genesis Dubai, in the studio. We've had a message here saying, my 10-year-old daughter always walks on her toes since she was six. Is there something wrong? Or when she gets older, will it change? She walks like a ballet dancer. When reminded or hinted, she lands full feet on the floor. What could be at play there? And what would your advice be as a podiatrist, Sarah?
So I definitely advise getting it checked out. Certainly if parents are concerned about it. Things that I look at as a podiatrist would be, does it affect activity levels? Is there any pain? Are there any complaints? But it might be something that we have to look at as a multidisciplinary approach as well.
So worth looking at, you know, as you said, that kind of like the, you know, foot and muscle tone, functionality, yep. All of that. So would first put of call go to the family doctor maybe even before seeing a specialist such as yourself?
Yeah, family doctor or the paediatrician.
Perfect. Hope that helps. We've had a message here saying one of my toenails has been dead for 15 years due to fungus. There's no itching, no harm, but the nail looks like shrunken skin. Can it be treated? I'm 47. And if we do treat it, will the nail come back? Can we offer some hope?
Hope for the toes. If it's been tested for a fungal infection is one of the first things I look at, because sometimes it's not a fungal infection. So sometimes patients are treating it as a fungal infection, and it's not. There might be, again, biomechanical things going on, or is it something that we need to manage conservatively with different types of creams, lotions and potions? But I'd like to always have hope that toenails can improve.
Oh, what a note to end the show on. What a note. Sarah, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having
me. We've had a bit of a whistle-stop tour of the lower limbs today. For any messages that we didn't get to, or indeed you want to get in touch and ask for the details, just send me the word foot or the foot emoji. And Sarah, with your permission, I'll share your link for Genesis website so people can find out a little bit more. Thank you so, so much. And And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.